Good evening, everybody. Lovely to see you. Hi, everyone. Natalie, are we Paulless?
Oh.
Are we Paulless?
Yeah.
It's going to be quiet.
And you?
Yes, it will be nice and quiet.
There'll be no wife jokes, at least. Yeah, okay. I'm recording. Okay, fine. Let's see what we can do. Make sure that is started. Okay. Oh, well, good evening, everybody. It's so wonderful to see you here. Welcome to session 5 of 6 of the Jewish Philosophy course. What I'd like to do today is I want to move at a bit of a pace because we're on page 45, right? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Now, I was thinking this is a very, very big chapter. It's called Man, which is a big chapter. And it goes all the way, believe it or not, to page 59. And the way that we do it, we may get there in like 14 years. So what I didn't want to do is take 14 years over it. So what I did want to do is try to kind of aim that I could at least do half this week. Ish and half next week, so we could end up finishing that entire chapter if it's within the realm of possibility. Does that make sense? Is that good? Okay, so what I want to do is I want to go back for those that were there last week, or for anyone that managed to listen to the recording from last week. I just want to go over a little bit of recapping as to what we've done so far, which is absolutely humongously ginormous and abstract stuff. Do you need a copy of the safer? Do you need anything? You okay?
You're recording it, yeah.
I am. Is that all right for you? Is that good?
I'm just checking.
Thank you so much. What would I do without you? Thank you. It's great. So we've managed to cover quite a bit of ground. Let's just do a little bit of a recap over what we've done. We've done 2 chapters, which are the most abstract chapters in the book. It doesn't get more abstract than that. It's the most intense material that's available. We did the creator and we did the purpose of creation. And we knocked that out in basically 2.5 sessions. I think it's pretty good for Jewish philosophy sheer world. I think that's what should be pretty good. So, just let's do a little bit of recap. The creator is as follows. Very little to say about him. We talked to that he's a being, it's a being outside of the realm of dimension, outside of space, outside of time, outside of anything like that at all. All that we can say about him is that he's devoid of any imperfection, i.e. that he is perfect. And that is basically the conclusion of section 1. Would anyone... That's basically it, right? That's the bottom line. That he exists, it exists, it must exist by necessity of its own perfection. It's got to be here, it exists. The question, the big question which came into section 2 is, what is he doing? What does he want? What's going on? What's it all about? The Barber question. Remember the Barber question? What's it all about? And the answer is, what's it all about? The answer is very, very simply, this being wanted to give of its good to another. Do you remember that? That was the conclusion of last week's session. Is that... So am I ringing any bells? Richard at the back.
Yeah.
Ringing about fantastic. Yeah. Ronnie, does that make sense? Is that, yeah. So this being wanted now, the question was, well, why did he want that? And the answer is there's no possible way we could explain it because every want that we've ever had always is based or predicated upon a need. And he can't have any needs because if he had any needs, he wouldn't be perfect. Does that make sense? Is this all ringing some kind of like bell where you don't feel as if I'm just speaking gobbledygook? Well, you may think I'm explaining that anyway. But let's say it should be at least be material that you feel as if you know that we've covered. Oh, then we had a problem. We had a massive problem. We said as follows. We said, if those axioms are true, that there's this perfect being who wishes to give of his own or its own good to another, anything he gives it to is never going to be as good as him. So is that Richard at the back?
Yeah.
Rich, who was said that? Was that Richard at the back? Yeah, Richard at the back.
I didn't say anything.
Oh, who said I didn't get that?
Who said I didn't get that? It sounded like a recording.
It was
on a recording.
In my pocket, I think.
It was a Siri thing, isn't it?
Was it your pocket?
Yes, guilty.
What, your pocket says I didn't get that?
Not.
On a regular basis?
No, unfortunately, just at that minute.
He's doing a secret recording of his own, I think.
I think it's absolutely brilliant to bring that machine to a Jewish philosophy sheer and just have it go off every several minutes. I didn't get that. Just a recording. I really sounded like Richard in the back. Just said, I didn't get that. Did you?
My voice
is
nothing like that.
No, I know, but it came from your direct. Did you hear? That really did sound as it. I thought someone's got a problem. So hold on, did everyone get what I said? Is that okay?
Yeah.
So is this just a phone kind of ringtone?
It's just a beam from another dimension.
Unbelievable. Okay, that's the first time that's ever happened. That is fantastic. It's a brilliant heckle. I've been heckled, but I didn't get that ringtone. I could just think of brilliant others. Like, you should also have, by the way, if you've got an I didn't get that ringtone, I think you should also have, could you please give me a source for that? And this should also be programmed, like, can I have a source for that? And could we go over that one more time? I think there should be a good gamut of them. That'd be brilliant. Okay, so let's not lose track. All right, so we talked about this perfect being, and we said that it wanted to give its good to another, but that led to a massive problem, because whatever it gives its good to isn't as good as it. So we said, what is it that this being could give? And the thing that we had to conclude was only itself. Now, I want to go back to the Paul and Natalie analogy. There was a Paul and Natalie analogy from last week with a ginormous cardboard check that was awarded to them for playing the lottery which they didn't win. If you remember that, those that were there, right?
They still not had the check.
No, that's because there's all kinds of problems with it. It's very too big to get to the post box, and the post box is very small. It's a huge check. Can't get it to that. Okay. I don't know how that was. So anyway, so talking about their check, now there's a couple of little things that I want to fill in on that analogy now, which will really help us with what we're doing today, which I didn't do last time. Didn't do last time because there was so much to do anyway last time anyway. It's like this. Paul and Natalie were told that they've won this £45 million, whatever it is, rollover week by a psychic rabbi who said that had they have played the lottery, those were the numbers they would have. In the meantime, they've gone to St. Moritz with a super yacht that's really mine, and they've renamed it. And they're going to this party, and was it Stephen Jefferson or whatever his name was, came up to them and said, come along to a soiree that we're having tonight. And they were getting themselves ready. In the meantime, Paul gets jitters, thinking, oh my gosh, obviously I've been stupid. Where did he get the money from? This is ridiculous. What's going on? He had doubts about it. He had doubts about the legitimacy of the gift. Then when he got there, everyone had heard, like wildfire, this ridiculous story of a guy that met a psychic rabbi and gave him a massive check of all this money. And they don't feel as if, frankly, they don't feel as if he's welcome. Because they own airlines or whatever like that. And they're there because they deserve to be there because they've worked for it. And he doesn't deserve to be there because he didn't even play the lottery. And he's one that has at work. Made them feel very tense. Two levels of uncomfortability. Uncomfortability one is that they're worried, number one, how do I get this reward? How is it possible that I'm here? How do I get that? It doesn't feel as if it's really justifiable. Number two is, it's making me feel uncomfortable that everyone else feels uncomfortable around me. I feel uncomfortable about that. I walk into a room and I'm like, oh, I don't want to talk to you. So what's wrong with that? And that's not a brilliant reward. There's another element to this analogy which I just want to bring in. I'm going to bring in, this is a really strange analogy. It's my analogy, you don't like it, that's fine. But as long as you can get this, a really strange analogy. Imagine you won the rollover. And you've decided to buy a beautiful mansion in Rolling Hills. That's, let's say, what you wanted to spend the money on. You spend the money on that, and you've got this lovely, lovely house. You settled in, you've got an interior designer in, you've just done it up the way you like it. Lovely. It's your first week in the property. And then you see one of these great, massive, like Pickford's kind of moving trucks. Oh, and there's neighbours. Neighbours have bought the mansion next door. Oh, very nice. Takes a couple of weeks, take a while to do it up. Anyway, one morning, you go out to collect the mail, which is a long walk. You maybe could take a cycle all the way to the front gate. And the mailman leaves the stuff at the front because you can't get in. You've got a security gate system and stuff like that. So you have the security gate system and you open the gate and you get all your mail. And you look to your left and there's a man in slippers and a bathrobe. And he's also getting his mail. And you look over and you see that it is Adolf Hitler, Yimach Shemo V'zichron. And you look over, and he's like, you've got the hair, you know, the hair like this, a little moustache, and he's a little bit maybe not clean shaven, and he's getting, so he looks at you, and he goes, Guten Tag! And you're like, and then he just turns around and goes in. You walk back up your path, and you sit down, maybe your spouse, whoever it is that's at home, go, have you any idea who moved in next door? No, who are the people? I think it's the Hitlers! I think the Hitlers have moved in next door! Really? What, the Hitler? Yes, you know, the famous World War II Hitlers. They moved in next door. Now, you have very expansive ground, several acres of garden at the back. He has several acres of garden. So you don't really see his house, and he doesn't see your house. Let me ask you a question, and I'm speaking here for the tape to the majority to Ashkenazi Jews in this room. How would you feel about that? I would feel incredibly uncomfortable. Incredibly uncomfortable. Incredibly uncomfortable. That's analogy one. Well, that's actually analogy two. Let's go back to analogy one with Paul and Natalie and a giant check. They turn up to that soiree and they feel uncomfortable. they feel uncomfortable because they're now starting to feel as if maybe this is illegal. Where did the money come from? Maybe it really isn't legitimate. That's a worry. Number two, they're worried that everyone doesn't feel as if they fit in. Let's look at the other way around. Let's look at the people that are on the block. And you, like the Hitlers, are you okay? Is everything all right? Do you want, okay. And you're and then the Hitlers moved in next door to you. You would feel incredibly uncomfortable. Why would you feel uncomfortable? Because you feel as if this person doesn't belong anywhere near you. Right? You don't want them near you. The people themselves who Paul and Natalie are trying to socialise with at this soiree are themselves feeling uncomfortable because they themselves don't feel comfortable being next to Paul and Natalie because they don't feel as if they justifiably are there. So that's an issue which I want to discuss now because that's going to be very, very much coming into the chapters that we're going to be discussing today. When God gives a good, we said that he can't give anything unless it's perfect, which is why we discussed them all the way back to section one. And the first lecture that I gave was that there's nothing he can give except for himself because anything he gives is somehow deficient. Even a beautiful yacht, there's careening problems and tax problems and port and harbour fees and football hooligans ripping it up and the cushions falling out the back and you have to get custom-made cushions only from Italy and stuff like that. It's a real problem when you own a super yacht. So even though it's a nice thing, there's lots and lots of problems. The only thing he can give is himself. Now, that leads to massive issues. Issue number one is that if an individual feels as if they've just been plonked with the reward that God is going to give them, they're A, going to feel uncomfortable because they feel as if they didn't earn it, i.e. they never played the lottery. You see how this fits in with the analogy? Number two, when they're hanging around other people who have justifiably got it, they won't feel uncomfortable. Sorry, they'll feel uncomfortable because the other people will feel as if they don't belong. And the last thing is this moving into the Hitler's business, is that the other people who are already there will feel as if their presence there is actually diminishing their own repose, even though it's not doing anything negative. Hitler is just living next door and doing crossword puzzles on Sunday now. Now they've lost their all and stuff like that. He's no threat. But the fact that his mere presence is there makes me feel uncomfortable in my own. All of these things remove perfection. All of these things are imperfections. And because they're imperfections, God cannot do it. Because if he were to do it, it would be imperfect giving. And if it's an imperfect giving, he can't give an imperfect giving. Which explains why we ourselves have to go through this life cycle in order to really know what it is we were able to achieve and weren't able to achieve so we don't have any of those problems. We really did play the lottery. We really did win it. We really did get the check. It really did cash all kosher and everything like that. And now it's normal. This is all good. And people like Hitler won't be living next door to people that don't deserve to live next door to Hitler. Because if they did, the whole... Oh, there's a button again. If they did, magic, do it again. Oh, if they did, it would be a problem for everyone. So is that making sense so far with the analogy with Paul and Natalie? Do you remember we got that? Is that making sense with everyone? Does everyone feel comfortable with that? This is a good time if you don't feel comfortable. I didn't get that. Any questions on that so far? Leon, any questions? Okay, people. So we talked about that, so we've got all that. Now we are on page 45. Now, it's very important to keep in mind that everything that we're discussing at this moment until we get to page 49 is all design stage. We're executive meeting, round the board table, talking about the ultimate creation that God could make that would be fitting for this. Not where we are now, not how we came into the world now, nothing like that, okay? All right, let's do page 45, is that okay? Dovi, are you with me? Have you got page 45 there?
I do.
That is... Have you got a pad on the iPad? Really?
Did you just think I'm sitting here...
No, I didn't know what you were doing. I was just quite... You didn't have a book. And okay, Dovi, would you... Okay, it doesn't matter. I'll do it. As we've discussed, man is the creature for the purpose of cleaving to God. We said that at the end of last week's session. Only man is placed between perfection and deficiency with the power to earn perfection. Now, remember, this is not where we are now. This was the design stage prior to making everything kind of thing. Now, this creature who we're going to call man, or humanity, must earn this perfection, earn it, because of all the things that we discussed last time, through his own free will and desire. If he were compelled towards perfection, i.e. slanted towards winning the lottery, where the dice are loaded when you're playing that, you know, the game, as it were, then he wouldn't really be the master of it. Because he's being forced into a situation where he's going to get it anyway. very much like winning the lottery when he didn't play it. Rather, he who compelled him would be responsible, and God's purpose would not be fulfilled. So God loading the dice for man to win would actually be a negation of the entire purpose. It was therefore necessary that man be given free will. First time we've discussed this. And balanced between good and evil. Now, what's good and evil? Remember, we defined good and evil last week. What is good? What is evil? Okay. Hands up. Good. No. Okay. Good and evil. It's like this. Do you remember good and evil? We discussed good and evil at the end of last week. Good is close to what God wants, and evil is far from what God. That's what good and evil is. It's either in line with this protocol or out of line with it. That's what we call good and evil. And there's different varial. There's different varieties of good and evil that he's made. Like some things are very evil, some things are very good, etc. Some things aren't really that good, and some things aren't really that evil, depending upon how out of line they are with that absolute anchoring point. I think do you remember we discussed that last time? Do you remember that? Okay. It was therefore necessary that man be given free will and be balanced between good and evil and not be compelled towards either. That's a good thing to make a point here. This was Adam before the sin. Just make a little bit of a scribble on the side if you have a pencil. Make a little bit of a gloss. If anyone needs a pencil, do you need a pencil? Anyone needs a pencil? I've got a spare one here. Is that this is not us now. We'll talk about that later on page 49. Now this being, this human, has the power of choice and is able to choose either side, i.e. in line with what God wants or out of line with what God wants, knowingly and willingly, and possesses whichever one he wishes. Man was therefore created with both a good urge, literally an inclination towards the good, which we're calling the Yetzer Hara, which literally means inclination to good, and an evil urge, Yetzer Hara. He has the power to incline himself in whichever direction he desires. And I've added in through free will or choice. Now, it's a really important, just let's get this a little bit clear here. Man's free will, according to what we've just read, is actually the outcome of a tussle. Mm. It's a tussle. There's something which says, don't do it. And there's something which says, do it. And these do it, don't do it, so whatever the actual particular case is in, you fill in the blanks however it works in your particular example, is either the Yetzer Hara or the Yetzer HaTov when it comes to a free will decision. Now, free will decision is quite rare. Quite rare. Richard at the back, can I ask you a question? If I were to offer you a cup of tea or coffee right now, what would you choose?
Neither.
You would choose neither. Okay, Ronnie, if I were to ask you, you would choose a tea. You would choose a tea. Now, Ronnie, before I ask Ronnie anything further, for everyone else in the room but Ronnie, why is Ronnie choosing tea? Do you think that's a free will decision?
Well, it's based on his own taste and experience.
Right. Ronnie, basically, and I would also choose tea, by the way, is because Ronnie has basically enjoyed more pleasure from tea at this particular time than he would have done from coffee. So asking him whether or not he wants tea or coffee, saying, which of these two pleasures would you like right now? I'll take the better one, please. Out of the two, I'll just go for the one I enjoy the most. Would you say that that accurately answers why you would go for tea over coffee?
Almost. I believe there's less caffeine.
Right, okay. And it's also possibly there's health benefits. There's a health benefit and a pleasure benefit. I personally would go for the tea, not because that would be, I simply enjoy...
It's not a free range. It's not like, say, would you like a drink?
No, I'll tell you this. If you say you want to like a drink, you're basically saying, which drink would give you the most pleasure now? Some people may say a whiskey.
Yeah.
Some people may say a beer. Some people may say a cocktail, a pina colada.
It's a limited choice.
Even the choice itself isn't really free in this case, as we're defining it now. What I'm really saying is, based upon your previous life experiences and all the attitudes that you have towards this thing, what do you want to go for? That's not really the free choice that we're discussing here. Let me explain what the free choice is that we're discussing. It has to be an absolute 50-50 pull between good and bad in your own self, and it has to involve a divine commandment. Otherwise, it's not really free choice. So it's like this. An individual sees Granny Smith crossing the road. I always bring up Granny Smith. And he's got a gun in his hand for whatever reason. There's a free will choice. If an individual is of that lower level, basal kind of visceral person, where he doesn't mind murdering old ladies, then he has a choice whether or not... Now, I think for the vast majority of everyone in this room, I think it's fair to say that I wouldn't have this as a free will choice. Because you just wouldn't murder an old lady for no reason, right? But if an individual is on that level and he's got a gun, he could shoot Granny Smith, or he may not shoot Granny Smith. And if his evil inclination is telling him, shoot Granny Smith, steal her wallet and go to John Lewis and buy CDs. And then his good inclination says no, because there's a commandment that says, thou shalt not kill. And therefore, I shouldn't do it, because I may be getting into trouble, or there's I feel bad with my conscience, or whatever the reasons are. Now he has a tussle. Now, free will choices are really much, much, much tighter than that. They're usually, they're unique for every individual, but they will always involve a mitzvah, and they will always involve an absolute tussle between good and not good within yourself. Those are extremely rare. You may have maybe one a day, I don't know, maybe one a day, maybe, if that. The vast majority of our choices, quote unquote, that we make, isn't an outcome of this intense, powerful free choice that we're talking about. It's merely, what do I use? You know, when I put on my shoes today, did I really have free choice to put it? I could put on those shoes. I'm not going to put on shoes. So is it really a free will choice? No, it's not going to put on the shoes. Whatever's in front of me, those ones I put on those. Right, those are my shoes. I should put on shoes and I shouldn't put on shoes because it's just, I shouldn't put it. There's no real free choice. That's not, you understand what I'm saying here? Does that make sense to everyone?
Yeah.
So the free choice that we're talking about is an outcome of internal strife. Something's pulling one way, another thing's pulling another way, and then you choose. You say, I am going to go with this particular choice. Now, once you make that choice, you imbue the ability to do that because it comes as part of you. So let's... Someone comes around one of these. Now you know, or you may know, I assume you know, that it is an extremely righteous thing to give charity. It is a mitzvah to give charity. So someone comes around you and sure, whatever, you're talking to your friend, someone's doing that. What's happening now is there's a mitzvah choice as to whether or not to reach into your pocket and put a coin in the pushka or not to do it. Now you may have internal strife about whether or not to do that, but let's say you put your hand in your pocket and you put a coin in the box for the first time you've ever had this kind of choice. Do you know what happens? You become a Baal Tzedakah. You become an individual who's mastered the act of giving charity at that level. Now that you've done that, your next free will choice isn't quite as acute as that previous one. Because it's the first time you've ever been faced with these concepts. Do you hear what I'm saying? Therefore, and if you get a thing where every Tuesday in the afternoon you always put in £1 of it, then it becomes a planned behaviour and it's not a free will choice. It's just part of your routine, part of the system, part of something you do. Do you understand what I'm saying? So this free will choice is relatively rare and then leads to changes. Now, let's say you've got a question I'm going to come to. Let's say an individual, the thing's chugging around and the pusher's chugging around and you say, you know what, I'm not going to give it. Totally free will, never been in this situation before, you know, should I give it, shouldn't I give it? And whatever miserly, you become miserly, become stingy and you say, I'm not going to give it. The next time that box comes round, it's going to be harder for you to work towards giving that stocker. It's not the same free will choice anymore. Which means every free will choice is actually completely unique to that time, place, and test. Does that make sense to everyone so far? Dov, you have a question?
Yeah, it's not on the... Well, I'll just ask a question. why do you say that it's only with things which are mitzvahs, which got free choice? What about, let's say, if somebody's got a free choice decision whether to smoke or not to smoke?
Smoking,
or,
look, I don't want to
say
it's a tough one to touch because
let's say it's not so straightforward whether or not it's an avera or not, right? Or let's say you know, somebody's on a diet, okay, and he's got
whether or not
a
to contravene the diet.
There's a cream cake sitting on the table. Should I eat it?
If an individual is on a diet for self-image reasons, okay, we just take, for me to talk about smoking, I don't know, are there smokers in the room? I see there's smokers in the room. Yeah, smokers in the room. Smoke. Let's not talk about smoking. Let's talk about dieting, okay? If an individual is, let's say, for, I don't know, self-image purposes, feels as if they want to go on a diet, what they're really doing when they're balancing up that cream eclair, which is sitting beautifully in the fridge going, eat me, right? When it's doing that, what they're really doing is balancing up the priorities of the pleasure that they're going to get from chomping on that cream eclair to the guilt that they're going to feel about how they feel in other people's eyes and their own eyes. It's pleasure versus pleasure. When you have a mitzvah, that's only when... remember, we're talking here about good and evil. Good and evil. A free choice is a choice between good and evil. I'm going to come to you later, okay? Good and evil. That free choice can only be... Now, there's different levels of evil and good in our lives, right? But if an individual, let's say, has a health condition, let's say, chas v'shalom, they've got a condition where they can't eat cream eclairs, specifically, and they could come out with a terrible rash, and they could really, you know, chas v'shalom, need to go to hospital and stuff like that, then they have a mitzvah not to eat it, because you're not allowed to eat poison. There's a natural b'chol nafshichem, there's a natural mitzvah that says you're not allowed to do things which damage your body. If you know, I'm not just talking damaging your body, like, I'm talking about self-image, I think, like, taking poison, like, having cyanide and taking cyanide, it's osser to take cyanide, right? So we've been to do that. Unless, obviously, there's a medical reason to do it. Now, if an individual has a medical reason, let's say, where they know that they're going to become very, very ill, and they're going to be damaging themselves, then it enters the realm of life and death for them, and then that actually becomes in the realm of good and bad.
Diabetic.
Oh, let's say, I don't know enough about medicine.
That's
to,
what I am,
if you're
I'm
diabetic,
saying, yeah. So
if
I'm
you were to eat an
entire
eclair, something bad would happen.
Correct.
Now, therefore, this isn't just a body image. This is like, hustle, you don't want to get sick.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if an individual says, but I love cream eclairs and stuff, like, I can't help myself, then when that cream eclair is sitting there, it's like basically to someone else who isn't diabetic, is a can of poison.
Yeah.
It's literally eating a can. I remember I met an individual with anaphylaxis, which is an intense allergic reaction to peanuts. Like, they literally turn lobster red and strawberry. And he said to me, when he sees a jar of Skippy, for those listening, I don't know who you're listening, it's a brand of peanut butter, which is an American brand of peanut. It's like, that is a jar of, like, nerve gas or something. It's like the most... You see, to me, it's like, nice things put on bread. Mmm, good with jam, good with chocolate spread. It's also good. For him, it's not good. This isn't good. It's like a grenade.
Yeah.
It's a grenade, okay? So for him, he actually sees it differently. Now, for him to want to eat peanut butter, it's basically saying, does he want to put himself in A&E? Now, if he's going to do those all kinds... there's difficulties in the analogy, but the point is that if you're going to be talking about a choice between good and evil, you have to define good and evil. Is it the closeness to God's will or distance from God's will? Putting on that pair of shoes, another pair of shoes, which are both halakhically completely permitted, isn't so much a choice possibly of God's will, unless you get to, the basic thing is God doesn't mind whether or not you wear those shoes or those shoes, let's say, right? Okay, you know what I'm saying? It's not going to be a mitzvah and a veira to put on those shoes or not those shoes, in which case it's just whatever you fancy at that time. If God says you can't wear those shoes because they're actually live crocodiles and they could really hurt you, and that's on a pair of shoes or whatever like that, then it becomes a tussle between what an external authority has told you and what your internal drives are saying.
Right, but I mean, in one of his other books, in the Ramchal in Masilas Hashorim, he says that everything is a challenge for a person.
He says it in here, now, doesn't he? He says it in here. Every single thing in an individual's life, everything in his station or her station, everything exists as a challenge. But that challenge doesn't necessarily mean a free will choice. It puts you in a predicament which will give you challenges. And those challenges will have knock-on effects to the kind of choices you're making. Where you live, what ethnicity you are, what socio-cultural status you have, where you go.
So which pair of shoes to put on could be a free will choice?
It could be if there's a mitzvah involved. But again, I will get to that. It's a section two thing. Every single thing in your life, everything, whether you're male, you're female, who you are, everything exists as a challenge. Rich or poor, anything like that, both of those are challenges. Everything's a challenge. But that doesn't mean because you're rich or you're poor that that's a free will choice. The free will choice will be predicated based upon the station you have in life. And when you're having in life, the kinds of free will choices you have are different from someone else and a different free will choice. Which is why, by the way, in Olam Haba, which is the place where we're going to get the reward, according to Jewish philosophy, for the choices, everyone is on a completely unique plane. No two people are in the same place. Because no two people have exactly the same predicament, exactly the same choices, and made the exact same outcomes. That's why it has to be unique. That's why it has to be individual. Okay? Any other questions on that point so far? Elaine had a question.
I'm not quite sure whether it is on the same level, but you are invited to give tzedakah, and you've no objection to giving tzedakah. You're quite happy to be charitable. And you then notice that the label on the tin says aid for Syrian
whatever Quaff aid
or ISIL or whatever. You then cannot in conscience, your rational being says, I can't give my money.
There are laws guiding you as to what is considered tzedakah.
Okay.
So there's a whole range of laws as to what is considered a charitable act, and there's a range of what is considered to give something charitably to.
Right.
Okay? So you would have to go to your data bank knowing what it is that is actually considered a mitzvah at that particular time,
right,
and act accordingly. I'm not going on the minutiae of the detail.
No,
all I'm saying is that basically, the basic point is you're challenged to a point that you do want to do a mitzvah and you don't want to do a mitzvah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a choice comes out so where you... Now, your choice there is the result of an internal strife.
Right.
I do, I don't. I do, I don't. And then you plump for one. That is true, honest to goodness, free will. Okay? Is everyone else... So far, so good.
Yeah. I know
you're
doubting it.
Go for it.
No, because I was thinking that I kind of think the opposite to Dobby. I never have those free will choices, like, but it's so finely balanced. Because on the whole, you want to be a good person and do what God wants you to do. So it's always tipped in that way.
But I think it's fair to say that all of us must have done things which maybe were naughty.
Yeah.
Is that true? It's not for me. I'm not trying to. Heaven forbid. I'm not. But have you ever done anything ever that was not? I'm naughty all the time. Me, I'm always. No, the point is that you those points that you knew that you'd done something naughty could only be because you made a choice to do it. Otherwise, you would never have been naughty ever. You would have turned around and said, "Listen, I've never been naughty," and I would ask you for a blessing.
Like,
well, that's how it works.
As you grow.
Yeah. The goalposts change. You're right. As you go, that's a human perspective, by the way. I have a fascinating thing to tell you about the Garden of Eden. When we get to this concept of the Garden of Eden, when the snake says to woman, you'll know good and bad. God doesn't know good and bad. That's down to us. God is unaware of good and bad. That's a human concept. What is God aware of? Good and bad are human concepts.
What is
God aware of then?
Himself,
what is the truth
and distance from himself?
Truth and falsehood. Good and bad. Now I tell you, when I was 16, what I thought was good is not what I think is good now. That's really true. Really is true. And if you look at your lives, you thought the coolest thing in the world when you're 16 is to be, and now it's like, not so sure. Not so sure. Because things change. So what's good and bad is down to your particular perspective. God ain't talking about good and bad. He's talking about truth and false. There's absolute truth. That's his signet, is truth. Good and bad is for you. And as you grow, good and bad shifts. Look, if a guy's growing up and he's got sugar from a friend, mamish mad from a friend, and they're going to shul 3 times a day, you may turn around and say, well, that's bad. You may think that's bad. But if you decide to learn a lot more, right, and be involved a lot more, you may try to go, wow, I'm really impressed. That's really good. And things change. Your attitudes and views of things change. Not for God. He can't change. He can't go anywhere. He can't do anything except for be him. Because if he could do anything else or change, that means he'd be imperfect. We've already got this. This stuff should now start to be fitting on a bedrock that we're starting to build. It's got to all be making sense, right? Everything's got to just make sense. Leon.
You said that it's rare that we'll come across maybe once a day free will choice.
Yeah, the greater the person, the more they have free will choices. That's why the Gemara Brachos points out, if you haven't had a free will choice in 30 days, worry.
But I would have thought that most people would have more.
You know what? I haven't taken a stat with Gallup. I haven't gone round. Hello there. How are you? Working for Gallup? I don't know.
You mentioned giving tzedakah, yeah? So it's not every... even if you're in the habit of giving, you might suddenly decide you don't want to give.
Very good. Or you may decide to give a £50 note instead of a 50p piece. Something changes. Right? So a bigger tzedakah opportunity comes along. So I says, listen, I can see you give tzedakah. We're opening a thing in a hospital, a Shabbos room in a hospital. We really need help. It's a really vital thing. Please, can you help? You're like, well, now that's what I've never done that before. I mean, how much do you want? £1,000? I mean, 50p is one thing. £1,000. That's a new free will choice for that person. It's a massive investment of tzedakah. Can I take a detour for literally 3 minutes? It's a detour. It really is a detour. It's a proper detour. It's not on page. You've heard the story of the fox with the orchard, right? Fox is walking around and he looks and he sees the most beautiful orchard he's ever seen. And he starts panting. Ah, I've got to have those grapes. He looks around and he's walking around and he's trying to find a way into the orchard. There's one little hole. And the hole is too narrow for him to squeeze into. So he sits outside and fasts for 3 days solid till he becomes emaciated. Then he kind of like butters his way through the cat flap of that little hole in the fence and he's in. He mummish gorges. He gets a fox, big tummy, he just can't even move legs up like that. He's eating all the grass. He had a great time in that orchard. Oh, he's a cartoon fox like Mr. Greedy from the Mr. Men. Can't move. Woo, well, that was good. I had a lot of grapes right there. Then he looks at this one. Whoo, better go. Then he tries to get out. And of course, he's got only the same hole that he came in with. So he sits there and he has to fast for 6 days. 3 days to wear off the grapes and another 3 days to get emaciated again. And then he finally squeezes himself out. When he gets back out, he looks into the orchard and he says, "Orchard, oh orchard, what did I gain from you?" What should the fox have done? If he'd have gone to a Jewish philosophy shit at Whitefield Shore, he'd have been cleverer than that. He'd have gone, "Aha! This will be my brand new thing to do." What would the fox have done?
Brought the grapes up.
Right! He'd have got into the fence and he'd have chucked them over the fence! As many as he could! And while he was still in an emaciated situation, get himself out the fence and gorge to his heart's delight. This analogy is given about giving charity. The only money you keep is that which you give away. That's the truth of it. The grapes are like things that you want to keep when you cross over the fence. Only the stuff you've thrown over the side can you keep. I think it was worth doing that analogy. Let's go back into the text. We're on page 45.2. In order that God's goal be best achieved, which is what's God's goal? What is God's goal? Come on, guys.
Perfection.
No, that's not a goal, that's what he is.
No, I'm saying
to give of his good to another, to allow us to get close to him. For that to work out, the highest wisdom, which is euphemism for God himself, decreed that man should consist of two complete opposites. Unbelievable. These are one, his pure spiritual soul. It's spiritual. God's not spiritual. Okay? It's a soul. And his unenlightened, I would add in mammalian, primate body. It's an ape. Take an ape, stuff in a spiritual soul, and you're left with a human being. Each one of these things is drawn to its nature. The Beis Elokim, the Marabit says in the Chelik Beis, the Beis Elokim, humans walk bipedally. Animals don't. Says the reason for that is it's a natural order of things. Things go, electricity always flows on the path of least resistance. When you're pulling something from two ends, it's natural that it's going to go upright. If you're pulling up one and down from the other, the thing in the middle is obviously going to go vertical. We are walking around vertically because half of us, well, half of Adam, not us, we haven't got that yet, that's page 49. Half of this being is being pulled straight up, and half of this being is being pulled straight down. Half of it wants to be part of the earth, absolutely part of like a clod of earth, any physical repose, any niceness that it can get. Half of it is only involved in spiritual matters. And the middle bit is us. Each one is drawn toward its nature. So the body inclines towards the material, while the soul leans towards the spiritual. The two are then in a constant state of battle. See, this is the strife bit, right? If the soul prevails, it not only elevates itself because it did a good deed and that's what it's meant to do, but it also elevates the body, which is just a primate. It's a mammal. And it makes this mammal a vehicle for doing these amazing things. And the individual thereby attains his destined perfection. Now, this is all in the design stage. If, on the other hand, he allows the physical to prevail, then besides lowering his body into a more physical life, he debases his soul. Because his soul didn't want to do that. And now his soul has to get dragged along doing this thing which he doesn't want to do. Such an individual will be unfit for perfection and will be kept far from it, God forbid. Even so, he retains the ability to subjugate the physical to his soul and intellect and thereby achieve perfection. Now, I think we said at the end of page 43 a very important thing which should have been highlighted. The bottom point five on page 43, so if we just revise that for 1 second, I highlighted or underlined the elements of perfection which man must strive to perfect in himself are his intellect and positive character traits. And on the other hand, for the sake of acquiring perfection, the elements of deficiency that man must avoid are the material and mundane and negative character traits. See that? Now put that back in what we're saying. The whole point is of what he's trying to do is, because he says here, even so, he retains the ability to subjugate the physical to his soul and intellect. Those are the primordial spits of man, the best bits, thereby achieve perfection. Is everyone up to speed up until the end of point two? Any questions on point two specifically? Excellent. Let's do point three. This is an extremely important and new piece of data. Let me just, I'm going to read you something. Should be in here. Give me a moment. All right. I've got to, if I can, I'm going to be able to use this 4.4. Now, God's goodness decreed that there be a time limit. I've added in the word time. Time limit to man's effort required to attain perfection. Why should that be? Now, this is a phenomenally interesting point. After this period of effort is completed, he attains his level of perfection and is then allowed to enjoy it for all eternity. This was Adam prior to the sin. This is all in design staging. God therefore created two distinct periods. One is a time of earning, doing stuff in order to earn your rights, and the other as a time of receiving reward. As a general rule, however, that which pertains to good is always greater. The period of earning is therefore limited and lasts no longer than God's wisdom decreed suitable for his purpose. I'd like to give you an analogy. This is my casino analogy. I give it to pretty much everyone I meet. It's very difficult for parties for me to get along socially because I usually give them my casino. Hello there, have you met? I'd like to give you my casino analogy. Oh, goodness gracious, it's just a party. No, I know, but I think you'll like it. It's terrible, but you're here now, so you really can't escape the casino analogy. I've got to tell you about casinos, because casinos are amazing. They were built, all casinos exist, only for this analogy. This is amazing. You've got to hear this analogy, you're going to love it. Apart from the fact they're money-making operations, I'm not, that's a secondary thing. What is a casino? Drive by a casino and you can usually tell it's got no windows. It's a sealed box. Usually no clocks. Usually dimmed lights. All day, every day. And why is that? What's the first thing you do when you go to a casino? The first thing you do is you take real money and you give it to a lady behind an iron bar. And then she gives you toys. Mummish toys. She devalues the concept of reality and gives you little discs that say 200, 100. Why? So that you don't mind throwing it on the table, because if you saw £50 note thrown on the table out of your wallet, you would think more than twice. But a little piece of plastic, what's this? So it's all a trick to devalue. It's not real money. It doesn't say, I promise to pay the bearer on the sum of demand £50 worth of gold or silver or jewels or whatever. It's a plastic thing. It's a token. Then you go and play the game. And then at the end of it, if you've got any left, you leave. Or you have to leave, because they'll ask you to leave at some stage once you've got no more to give them. And then you have to see that same lady again. That lady's really in control. Because what do you do with the lady? You give her your chips. You say, now will you please convert this to reality so I can leave this place? And then she gives you real money and you leave. That is, you could not get a better example. Now, let me give you another twist to this analogy. I want to test the obedience of one of my new employees. His name is Kevin. Kevin, I want you to go in And I want you to put all your money on red on the roulette. All right, boss, I'll go do that. You give him some money, real money, and he turns to go do that. He walks in, the lady says, Kevin, before you go there, you give me your money, and then I give you the toys. So he gives him the money, takes the toys, right. He's off to the roulette table, off to put all of those things on red. And there's a guy in a suit, it's very smarmy, just looking at Kevin, he walks in. He comes up to Kevin like this. Kevin, nice to see you. I go, you know my name? Yes, I know your name, Kevin. And I want to tell you, is it right that guy told you to put all your money on red? Is that possibly? Yes, as a matter of fact, I was asked to come and help him. Because do you know why he's asked you to put all your money on red? Because actually, I've never thought about it. No, I don't know why. I'm doing it because he told me to do it. Because you know why? Because he knows if you put all your money on red, you're going to lose. And he's scared that if you put all your money on black, that you'll win and you'll end up richer than him. And then he'll be scared of you, he'll be intimidated of you. And he doesn't want that. So I just want to give you that friendly piece of advice there. That you should maybe think twice about putting all your money away. Because if you do, you're going to lose everything. That's just a little bit. Anyway, you enjoy your time. And the smarmy guy walks off. Kevin is now walking up to the roulette table with a tremendous amount. He's a relatively simple guy, Kevin. He's walking up with a relatively difficult choice. Yes, he knows he's got this thing with his job, his good boss is going to ask him whether or not he should do this. He should put it on red. He knows it'll be good for him to put it on red. But then he's very scared if he puts it on red and he loses all of it, yes, he's going to end up in a worse position. And this guy, this very helpful guy, has told him that if he puts it on black, he's going to make an absolute king. He'll make more money than his boss has. What is he need the boss? One directive is, your boss told you, put it on red. Another guy says, go against that. Now, why is the casino limited? Why must you go into the casino and go out of the casino? Why did the casino is obviously a great analogy for this world? Real currency is truth and false. And we hardly ever deal with that. We deal with toys. We're in and out of the casino, and when you leave, you check in what you've really got for reality. Right? Now, here's the thing. The Derech Hashem said that God decided that this world has to be finite. It must end. So we just read. Why must it end? What's the problem with it?
Not perfect.
What's not perfect about it? Think about the casino. What's imperfect in the casino?
The toys.
The toys aren't imperfect. What's wrong with the casino?
Lack of reality.
It's perfect reality for what it is within its own domain. It's a great casino for being casinos.
There's no reward system, it's chance.
But what's wrong in the casino?
Free will choice. The odds are slightly stepped in favour of.
Yeah, that's in this world. You're right, today, that's what it's like after Adam sinned. You're right. But that's not what's wrong. What's wrong? In that scenario that I've given you, what's wrong in the casino?
They're trying to trick you.
Who?
The people in the casino to tell you to take you away from what is real.
What's the real path?
What the problem is in this analogy of the casino is that guy that told him to bet on black.
Doubt.
Kevin was going in. What does it matter if I tell him to clean my garden? If I tell him to put everything on red? If I tell him to clean my garden, he cleans my garden, What's the problem? The problem is that guy that came up to him and said, What are you doing? You're going to put it on red? You know you're going to get hoodwinked by that guy? How can that guy exist? That guy is against it. I'm the prime directive. I'm the boss. I'm telling him what to do. If he does it, I'm really going to reward him. This guy is a problem. Who put the guy there?
It's temptation.
The boss.
I did. To see whether or not Kevin's going to listen to me. Had to. In fact, I only put him in a situation where that guy could come up to him and give him something to actually think about. I drank the whole arena, built the whole casino, have a groundbreaking and a party and champagne and make the casino happen and headers and register it with the tax office, you name it, so that there could be a fully functioning casino with people in it. So when Kevin goes in, I could send my agent in and really push Kevin. Now, when Kevin comes out and he says, listen, I bet it all on red. There was a guy that came up to him and told him to bet on black. But you know what? I didn't want to listen to him because he's not my boss. I just thought, you know, what can I do? Oh, Kevin, you have got the job. But any environment where that guy can exist is bad. The guy himself is negative. Where there's negativity, where there's bad, can't be forever. Why can't bad, negativity, lies, deceit exist forever? What did we learn in section one and chapter one and two?
Because God wants us to...
Forget us. Forget us. Why can't evil...
God's universe is perfect.
No, the universe is intrinsically flawed. It has to be because he created it, and if he created it, everything that's created must be flawed. Only he's perfect. Why can't imperfection last forever?
Because he does.
And if imperfection lasted forever, that would be bad. He wouldn't be able to tolerate that. So that guy has to have, that guy, the smarmy guy who I sent in, has to have a contract that's got to end. Because if he lives forever and he's constantly telling people, that actually starts to go against my protocol of testing Kevin. He's going to test everyone else now. I don't want to test Kevin. Evil must end. Because evil is evil. And if it went on forever, it would kibosh God's idea of giving his good to another. Because once he starts giving his good to Kevin, look, Kevin comes out and goes, I did it, boss. I bet it on red. I didn't listen to the guy. Kevin, you're a star. I'm going to take, you're going to go to the top, Kevin. And the guy comes up and says, no, he's not going to go to the top. He's got to come back in here and he's got to bet on black. No, Paul, we're going to call him David, whatever his name is. You finish your job now. Go back and I'll send someone else in. No, I have to, stop it already. Now he's getting in the way. His role is only to tempt Kevin at that moment and get Kevin to make a free will decision. Once he's made that free will decision, the entire casino and that smarmy guy all have fulfilled their purpose and no longer need to exist. Once he's cashed out his real money, I can send the excavators in and just destroy the casino. I don't need it anymore. I've tested Kevin maximally. He's come out with flying colours. What more do I need this casino for? It's all over. I've justified everything. When someone says, why'd you give Kevin the job? He's very loyal. I tested him. Came out trumps. Absolutely brilliant. And therefore, I've got to get rid of the casino because the casino and that guy who's in there is all a load of rubbish, basically. It's all a load of rubbish, which is taking away from Kevin's ultimate job in my office. Do you hear that analogy? It's an analogy. It's just an analogy. Little tricky bits of that analogy, but whatever. The general point is... It's that it's the smarmy guy. It's the smarmy guy that's the problem. Does that make sense? That's why...
It's the Yetzirah, yeah.
There you go. That's why the Yetzirah, it's a tool which must exist. I've got to build an entire framework just for that tool to exist. And then once it's used, I destroy it. What do I need it for? It's a problem, in fact. If I leave it going forever, it's always a problem. That's if I'm moving next to Hitler. If I'm moving next to Hitler once I leave the casino, I've made all that money in the casino, I buy a mansion, and Hitler lives next door. What's the point of working in the casino? I've got to get rid of people like him. Because it's going to ruin it for the winners. I've got to get rid of them. It would be a bad protocol if I didn't. This has all got to sit together and fit with everything we've learned perfectly. Okay? The period of reward, on the other hand, has no limit. And man continues to derive pleasure from his earned perfection for all eternity. The reason why reward has to be infinite is because reward is merely closeness to the Creator. There's nothing else he can reward us with. And the Creator's infinite. So you have to have an infinite opportunity to get close to infinity. Does that not make logical sense? If you only had one day to get close to infinity, that's a tough one. I want to read something to you. It's the Ten Commandments.
Heavy, man.
But it's only one of them. This is great. Listen to this. Anyone here good at maths? Or okay at maths? Just making one ratio. It's not that hard, okay? Number two out of the Big Ten. Number two says, you shall not recognize the gods of others before my presence. You shall not make yourself a carved image or in any likeness that which is in the heavens above. Like stars or anything like that. That which is in the earth below, animals, or that which is in the waters beneath the earth, sea creatures. And you shall not prostrate yourself to them, nor shall you worship them. Why? Because I'm a Shema God, I'm a jealous God. I remember the sins of fathers upon children to a third and fourth generation of my enemies. But I show kindness for thousands of generations to those who love me and keep my commandments. Now that's very interesting. He doesn't say this about punishment and reward anywhere else. Pretty much, I would say, in the Torah. It's the only time he gives us some data. Now listen to this. When he says, I remember the sins of fathers upon children to the third and fourth generations, what's the maximal then, if that's what he's given us? What's the worst that could happen? How many generations could it go on for the worst?
Four.
Four generations. You know why I'm talking about this. Four generations. Then he says, but I showed kindness, loving kindness, chesed, to thousands of generations, to those who love me. What's the minimum number of thousands? 2,000. That's the most conservative thousands. It could be 15, 20, 50, 60,000. I don't know. Just says thousands. I love it. But the minimum number of thousands is 2. And the maximum number of bad is 4. Which leaves us with a 4 to 2,000 ratio. Which can be cancelled down to what? 1 to 500. You're left with a 1 to 500 ratio from this very verse. Absolute bad. Now that, it's at least that good. It's at least that good. Because it could be that he only remembers to the third generation. And it could be he remembers to 25,000 generations. In which case it could be much better. But the minimum ratio is 1 to 500. Does that make sense with everyone? Which means the reward for a good is at least, no less than, 500 times greater to the punishment for bad. That's what he's telling us, right? And that's in the verse, right? We usually put like, you know, look, there they are, look. There it is, it's that one. Number two over there. Well, it's a very important statement. It's number two. And he's telling you it's at least 500 times better to get good. What I'm going to give you is at least 500 times better than whatever I'm going to give you if you do any bad. See, he's certainly got a lot more good to give than bad to give. With that in mind, let's read point four. Since the period of earning and that of reward are different, it's appropriate that man's environment and experiences be different in the two. Where it says since the period of earning, could you make a little note and call that this world? And where it says that of reward, could you call that the next world or the world to come? That's not where the dead people go when they die. That's not where they are. The next world doesn't exist yet, as we'll get to. While he's striving towards perfection, he must be in a setting containing elements necessary for such effort. What are those elements necessary for such effort? What must we be talking about? Good and bad. Got to have good things and bad things. Those are the elements of striving. I've highlighted the period of earning must therefore be one where a maximum challenge exists and where spiritual and physical are in constant strife. Have you got all that? That should be highlighted a couple of times and underlined. That is the absolute conclusion for what we're saying logically. There's probably quite a lot of revision you could do over what we've done previously to really, really nail that in. That's really the logical bottom line of it all. Now, in this environment, i.e. this world where there's good and bad elements, there must be, this is Adam prior to the sin, this is in his most perfect state, there must be nothing to prevent the material, the smarmy guy in the casino, from prevailing and doing what it can. And conversely, there must be nothing to prevent the spiritual from doing likewise. He's got to be able to put his chips on red if he so desires. They're not magnetically drawn to the black part of the roulette table. Nothing should exist that would give either one, good or bad, an inappropriate advantage. Now, although it might seem best to make the spiritual stronger than the physical and slowed the dice towards doing good, basically, in light of man's true purpose, which is to be tested maximally and feel as if it itself has earned the place that it gets in the soiree in St. Moritz, but with all those people that own the yachts, and what God actually desires of this creature, namely that he for himself earns perfection through his own effort, it wouldn't be good at all. We've got to keep him parv. We've got to keep this creature completely neutral and not slant him in either direction. In the period of reward, however, the exact opposite is appropriate. The more the physical would prevail, keeping the smarmy guy there, having Adolf Hitler live next door to you, the more it would darken the soul and prevent it from being drawn close to God. During the time of reward, it is therefore appropriate that the soul prevail and the physical be totally subjugated to it and not restrain it at all. It is for this reason that God created two worlds. Black and white, Jewish philosophical concept now. This world, known as Olam Hazeh, literally this world, and the world to come, Olam Haba, which just means world to, that is coming. The environment and natural laws of this world, the casino, are necessary for man during his period of striving, as we've discussed. The environment and laws of the world to come, on the other hand, are what are necessary for man during his period of reward, i.e. without having the smarmy guy or the casino. Does that make sense? Does it make sense in and of itself? You can have questions. Did you feel comfortable with what the material is trying to tell you? I'm now going to do the only time in the whole book I'm going to change the order of something. I'm not Linada going to do this at all for the rest of Sefer. I'm not going to read number 5, I'm going to read number 6, then I'm going to go back to number 5. When Adam was first created, this is the first man before the sin, he was precisely in the state that we have discussed until now. Composed of two equal opposites. What's that? His body, driving for everything, always wanting a foot massage and a pina colada. And the soul, always wanting to do good deeds. His environment, where he lived, had to contain both good and evil. Now, rabbis and rebbetzins, what is the good and evil in Adam's environment prior to the sin? This is a really good one. Think back to the casino. What's the good and evil in the casino? It's very simplistic.
Is good having...
Don't touch that.
Very good. So it's very good. The tree of knowledge saying don't touch that, that's a directive. Now, what is that directive? If we're putting it in our pans, our scale pans. That's the good. The good is merely a directive. Dovi, that's the mitzvah. That's the only good that's available. Everything else is a means to an end. The tree, the grass, squids, peanut butter, jelly, vultures are all just means to an end. The good bit is God saying, don't eat that. That's the good bit. It's got to be good. He's told us not to do it. What's the bad bit then? Right, the smarmy guy who says, what? You don't eat that? Come on, it's yummy. He doesn't want you to eat it because he doesn't want you to experience what's really yummy. That's the bad bit, because it's going against the prime directive. Doesn't that make sense? Doesn't that make sense with the sign with the casino? That's all there is. That's the good man. There's only two things. And notice, they're both external to man. The food is a food which is obviously not yet internalised. He's not eaten it. And the bad is some bloke telling him, do some bad. Not so for us today. So he was parav. The appropriate thing for him to have done would have been to have choosed good. That is the bottom line. He should have said, right, I'm not going to eat it. Had he have done so, that's the only thing he had to do, by the way, his soul would have overcome his body, the spiritual would have dominated the physical, because of a choice. When you give that 50p, your soul overcomes your body. You say, nah, keep it. So you overcome your body, right? He would then have immediately attained perfection, and that would have been it. It would have remained with him forever, and Olam Haba would have been instantaneous. That's all God needs. Remember what I said in a previous lecture? God is one God. He only needs one thing to do one choice once on one day. And he's completely justified. He just needs what to justify for this creature. He only wants one thing to do one choice once on one day. And we're done and dusted, can fold up the casino. Kevin's got the job and finished. So all we need in order to justify the whole system. Natalie.
Okay, so, this is completely wrong, but where does Havoc come into it? Because I thought it was her that told Adam to do the sin in the first place, therefore he's doing okay up to that point. Until she came along, he wasn't really making any...
That's change. Right. The thing is, the smarmy bloke didn't go up to Kevin. He went up to Kevin's wife. That's what happened here.
Okay.
The smarmy bloke didn't approach Kevin. Because he knew if he approached Kevin directly, he wouldn't be in for a chance. Because Kevin is really, really loyal.
I have to get to the weaker.
Yeah, be careful, because Paul's like, we can't do wife jokes now, because Paul's like... Let me explain to you. The real problem here, let me tell you something. The Nachash, the snake in the primordial Garden of Eden, encountered Chava, and he knew that women have more of an imaginative potential than men, and they imagine things more, which is why he said it's really good for eating. And she looked at it and she saw that she desired it for eating, because she had all these kind of imaginations about how good it's going to be. There was a problem. God said to Adam, don't eat it. If you look at a Chumash, what did the woman say Adam said to her?
Don't touch it.
Do you know what the snake did? He took his tail and he whapped her hard. She fell against the tree. And she didn't die. And she thought, well, hold on. If I touch it, I didn't die. Maybe I can eat it. Where did she get this idea? Don't touch it. Man gave her that idea. Her husband. Her husband turned around and said, listen. He didn't say this, but this is what he was thinking. If there's a jar of cyanide, let's put a fence around the jar of cyanide with a minefield. Let's not even go near it. Great idea! That is a fantastic idea to have security. It's a great thing to do. But you know what you need to do? You need to tell people about it. What he said to her was, if you even touch the tree, we'll die. What he should have said was, if we eat the fruit, we'll die. So let's make a rule, like muktzah on Shabbos, where we just don't touch the tree, and then if we don't touch the tree, we won't come to eat it. What a fantastic idea. He didn't tell her that bit. So she was walking around with a false preconception, thinking it was lethal to touch. That was a problem. It's a little bit specific, the answer I'm giving you. But the thing is like this. Even once she took of that fruit, and then she has it in her hand, and then she goes to Adam and says, try this. That's when his free choices kicked in. The Nachash never approached Adam directly. He doesn't need to. He'll get his wife to do it. That was a clever move. Because generally, if you can convince a wife to do something, then she'll convince the husband. That's how it works. And he knew that. So he doesn't have to get her. Sorry, he doesn't have to get him. He just has to get her. If you want to sell the idea of a new £30,000 kitchen to someone, the best thing to do if you're a salesman is get the wife to come in and convince her.
So does that mean if Adam hadn't have eaten it, even though his wife would have...
He'd have passed the test.
Men.
Now listen to you, women! You can ask this. The truth is the team failed. What he should have done is turn around and said, now why is it, by the way, she so desperately wanted him to eat it? This is what the Nachash knew. She ate it, which means she's now going to die. You know why she was so keen to get him to eat it? Because he's immortal, which means he's going to remarry and have someone else. She couldn't abide by that. He's going to be with someone else. God will have to make another wife for him, because she's going to die, right? That she's not having. She is going to use every part of her power to get him to eat that. In fact, the Medrash says she fed it to every animal. every animal she fed it to, except for one bird that wouldn't take of it, called the chol, which remains immortal. Every animal she fed it to bring creation down to her new state, because she couldn't believe that she's taken herself out of creation. She was so motivated now to get him to join her. That's what the smarmy guy knew. I can't be as motivated as she can to get this done. All I have to get is get her. Pretty clever Nahash. That's his job. He was the even the Torah says he was the most cunning creature. You couldn't get cleverer than him. Had to give Adam a maximal test. Had he, she come up and said, listen, try this for whatever reason. He was saying, I can't because I can't. And he'd still have won. That was the real test, was between man and woman at the end. The Nahash catalyzed that. Does that answer your question, Natalie? That's not a full yes. What's the problem?
No, I'm getting that.
Okay.
It doesn't sound a very equal test, though, doesn't it?
Sorry, what's the problem? Andy's asking, this isn't an equal test.
This has got the most cunning creature ever.
Versus who?
Versus Adam.
And who's Adam? The cleverest. It said that you know when you stand on your foot, there's a little bit of your ankle that pokes out a bit. It's not like a flat. The heel comes out at a little bit at the back of the foot.
Right.
That protrusion of his ankle could dislodge the sun off of its axis. And that's not obviously figure. It means that he was so great, he was being confused for God by the angels. The angels would come up to him and go, are you God? So God made him go to sleep. Because there's a verse that says God neither slumbers nor sleeps. He was so perfect. He was so complete that even angels were confusing him for the ultimate deity. Because they're looking for God as well. They don't know where he is either.
There has to be the ultimate. There has to be a maximum test. And therefore it has to be the maximum creature ever.
Excellent. The maximum creature ever versus the maximum creature ever versus the maximum test. And really, it can't even be the Nahash. It has to be his wife, who's really part of him.
Yeah.
Can't really be, because the Nahash is at the end of the day just some snake.
It's him versus himself.
Ah, because how was Adam and Eve originally created? Hermaphroditically. The back of man was woman. She was not created from a rib. It says from a bone from his bones, as flesh from his flesh. Have you noticed the back has like that dip in your spine? That's the operation scar, says the Zohar. Which means his wife was actually the back of his head and her husband was the front. It was one being and they moved together as one. They were completely homogenous. That's why there's no organs on your back. Have you noticed that? All your back is empty. That's because man was created like this. That was called Adam. And then he was split in an operation. God put him to sleep with general anaesthetic. And split him. It says that. He cast him into a deep slumber. And then took Chava away. And literally, that's why, by the way, our vertebrae look the way they do. Our vertebrae, which are the bones in our back, have two parts that come out to the side and one spinous process that comes back. Because it was pulled apart. It was only one vertebrae that was shared between two people. Literally split in half and then brought face to face. And that's why he said, now there's a bone from bones and flesh. This is it. I've been looking for my soulmate. And this is it. The question is, why did he even create her like that to start with if he's going to separate her? That's a specific question which we'll discuss. But really the test was from the other half of his own body and his soul coming straight back at him. That's got to be the ultimate test. Now, she's been inspired to do this. She didn't know. She's been inspired by the mistake. She's coming to him saying, do this! Which is why when God comes up to her and says, what have you done? What's the first thing man does? Blame his wife. That's the first thing he did. Do you want to say? He didn't even give an answer. He didn't say, yes, I did it. I'm sorry. I should have thought twice. He just turned around and goes, that woman you gave me, she did it. Notice God accepts that. Goes straight to her and says, what have you done? Playing past the parcel. She doesn't say anything. She says, he did it. The snake's standing there. Like, and God, notice, God doesn't ask the snake what he's done. He just punishes him straight off. Why? Because he spoke Lashon Hara. He spoke Lashon Hara. He slandered God. And said, you're going to be like God, no good and bad. And God told you not to do that. He's lying. People who lie, people who speak Lashon Hara, don't get a chance to defend themselves. That's what we learn out from that. The man was asked a question.
It was my wife.
God says, okay, so why did you do that? My wife said, he lied to me. You lied. That's it. You know, no, you don't. What did it ask the snake? Why did you do that? Well, you know, you told me to. So you used the way you did it. You lied about me. You misrepresented me. Immediate punishment. Maximal test. Maximal free will. Absolutely perfectly balanced. He was, should I obey God's directive of not eating? Or should I listen to my wife? Was she so very, very insistent about this? Notice he didn't eat the fruit itself. He ate of it. We learn out that she squeezed the fruit and she gave him the juice of that fruit. So it wasn't even, it didn't even look, you start rationalizing, right, it's not fruit, is it? So he didn't say about it, talk about the juice. Start to work it out. Is this all making sense? Is this starting to answer your question a little bit better, Natalie? The first sin was substance abuse. The Christians said something different. We know better. The first sin is the abuse of a substance. The Nachash today, absolutely guaranteed your money back, is a drug dealer. You take this man, your mind's going to open up and see things you have never seen before. What? Now look, you're in a club, right? I can't believe I'm going to do this. I shouldn't do it. I'm in front of a center. Let's pretend you're in a club and you're I'm going to jiggle in a very restrained manner that I'm in a joke. I don't really. And a drug dealer comes up to you and he offers you some LSD and you don't know what it is. And you say, what is it? And he goes, well, for £15, you are going to have a wild ride. Really? Yeah, you're going to see things which you've never seen before. Now, let me ask you a question. If someone came up touting LSD to sell you and they said that you take it, you're going to see things you've never seen before. And then you ask this following question, how long will it last? And they say, forever. This will change your mind forever. Would you take it? I think the vast majority of humans would avoid that. We're happy to have a trip for a little bit of time, 3-4 hours, 5 hours, 86, ooh, pretty heavy. But not for the rest of my life. Doesn't that prove that you know that this form of consciousness is therefore higher? Because if you really thought it was higher to take LSD and be forever like that, you'd have done it. You'd have said, yeah, let's go for it. But you know that's not as good, right? That was the Nachash's thing. He was a drug dealer. You take this, you abuse this substance, you take this drug, you're going to have a trip, and he sold it. He said what it is you're going to get. Your eyes will be opened to good and bad, which we've just said is actually a lower level of consciousness. Because their eyes were open, a level of true and false, right? Like God's. And you're going to be like that forever. And the reason you're going to take it is because God's scared of you. God is scared. He's scared you're going to be like him, knowing good and bad. That's what the verse says. That's not true. God doesn't know good and bad. He knows true and false. And he sold it to her. And she sold it to him. Pyramid chain marketing. Mm-hmm. It's a con. Everyone knows that. It's a con. And they lost. It had to be a maximal challenge. 100% pull left and right. He's in the middle, completely neutral. He hasn't done any good. He hasn't done any bad. If he does good, he's justified the Alps, treacle, giant squids, everything that's been built to give him this casino atmosphere. If he fails, not only does he bring himself down to an early state, everything is degraded and unjustified. What's the point of making the Alps if you're just going to fail it? The whole of creation, everything is resting now on his shoulders. Because God only made it to be able to give a choice to another creature so that creature could justifiably do the right thing, thereby earn points to be close to the Creator as much as it possibly could be. And therefore, God could fulfill his prime protocol of giving of his good to another in a justifiable, perfect way where there's no argument and the thing feels as if it really belongs there. It's not going to feel uncomfortable at the Samaritan. It's not going to feel as if it lurks next door to him. Everything's perfect. And the whole thing has to be perfect. He can't do it any other way because he's perfect. He can't do it any other way. So if he did, it wouldn't be a perfect giving. If it wouldn't be a perfect giving, it'd ruin the whole thing. This is a lot of data I've just... That was like 4 hours of work in that last sentence. You put in that time. By sitting here going through this material, I can just throw that out and you're like, yeah, that makes sense according to everyone. And notice, everything I'm saying is all based upon the building blocks that we've said right at the beginning, right? Remember, Adam is just a blue orange. He's just a blue orange. The God is literally dreaming up into a lower into a dimension at all. And giving this blue orange the opportunity to freely choose to bind itself to that which is energizing it. Or the opposite, move itself away of its own free will as much as it possibly can. Is this all starting to make... Is this clicking anywhere, people? Is this clicking? This should all fit.
I can see a problem.
Tell me the problem. Ah, great. Tell me that. I love it. What's the problem, Andy?
The problem is, if he had actually made the right choice...
Right.
That would be the end of it. That's correct. There wouldn't need to be great. I think he would be forever, the rest of it there. Yeah. There would be no need for the Torah. The Torah was... existed before, during, and after.
I love Andy. No, he always asks great questions. I told you. I said when he first came, he asked great questions.
It already existed before then.
Brilliant.
So therefore,
what's the point of it all? That was Adam's issue. He turned around and said, hold on. He saw from one end of the world to the other, says Zohar. Do you know what that means? He saw every generation that would come into the world had he sinned. You know who he saw? Rabbi Akiva. King David, God's personal friend. He saw Moses, the greatest prophet who ever lived. He saw the people walking out of Egypt. He saw it all. And he thought, if I don't eat of this, none of these people will ever exist. It's all wasted. You won't give the Torah on Mount Sinai. You won't have Moses. You won't have King David. You won't have all your favourite people. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the Arizal, the Ramchal. I want to put him up there.
We're just a trip of Adam.
Not a trip. We are the outcome of his error. But your question is, isn't that a problem?
Yeah.
The answer is, God knew that and told him not to eat of it anyway. His ego got involved. Now, I could just be a gardener and I'm the greatest living being who's ever existed in creation. And I'm now tending a garden and not eating a fruit. Not exactly a great use of my skill set, is it? Look what's going to come out of me. David, finally, God said, finally, I found my servant David. I love him. I'm going to stop David from coming. What about Moses and the Torah, the Egypt and Pharaoh and the 10 plagues? It's great. You wouldn't have needed it because it would be justified anyway. God was fully aware that none of that needed to happen. That's all post facto. Adam was thinking, if I don't do this, I'll have no individualistic expression in this world at all. That's where his wife got him. You're not going to eat of this.
Is that why it's called the Tree of Knowledge?
It's a beautiful question. No, because he had that knowledge prior to eating of it. Oh, thank goodness. Thanks for that. fell in. that was a great question. No, it really took... No, because the knowledge is actually bad. The knowledge is falsehood. Because good and bad, true knowledge of good and bad, is not as good as true and false. He knew all this before eating it, otherwise it wouldn't be a test. Oh, Elaine nearly tripped me. I stumped the rubber. No, it's great. Thank you so much. So now this is the answer. The answer to you is, yes, that's the very problem that tripped him up. Thing is like this. Let's say the Swami guy goes up to the casino and says, listen, you're going to do it. Let's say it's really true. He'd win if he bet on black. He'd bet on black. He'd win if he get more money than me. They turn around and go, why did you tell me to bet on red if you knew I was going to lose? I don't care about winning or losing. I care about you obeying what I'm telling you to do. Irrelevant of the outcome. I'm not interested in the outcomes. Will you do it? His ego said, well, I want more. I want to be the big Mayan. I want to do it. I want to allow these people to come to the world. I want these books of Torah to be given through my descendants. I want to do it. Because I know you want to do it, but I'm still telling you, notwithstanding that fact, that I don't want you to do it like that. It would be better if you just do it this way. Because he knows better. He's fully aware about the Torah being given in Moses and David. It's all down to him. What's good and bad anyway? Is there only what's close to him? He doesn't need to do the 10 plagues. He'll do it if necessary. But it'd be better had we just skipped the whole slavery business. You don't need to have a doctor if there's no Ebola. Let's just skip the whole Ebola thing and we won't have doctors. That was his choice. Do I want to be... So he wants to be primarily active in creation. The truth was, his prime activity in creation was just to avoid substance abuse. That was his entire directive. That's all God needed to justify the whole thing. Yes, nothing else would have happened. That's great. That's the way he wanted it. And can we really say, obviously there's been tremendous highlights, but there's been tremendous lowlights. I mean, really bad. If we could have just deleted all that and done it right to start with, wouldn't have been that been better?
So there's an easy way and a hard way, and we chose the hard way.
Yes. The hard way was choosing our ego. The easy way would have been choosing his. The truth is that God made something from nothing, and it's our job to make nothing from something. I'll say that again, because I think that's an important line. Heard that from Rabbi Nachman Bullman. Rabbi Nachman Bullman said, God made something from nothing, ex nihilo. Our job, if we really think about it, is to make nothing from something, i.e. our ego is always in the way. Now that doesn't mean we become nobodies and just destroy ourselves. It means that we've got to put it in perspective of the right thing. Sometimes when you go to see a doctor or a lawyer or an accountant, they tell you things which you don't want to hear. And you're going to have to just lump that and say, look, I'm going to have to bite the bullet and make the right choice here. Against my own egotistical desires. That's really what Adam was up against himself. Do I want to put my ego ahead of God's decision-making ability? What he's really saying is God's choices for me aren't as good as my own choices for me. And aren't we always saying that every time we have a free will choice? God says, don't eat this food. And you say, well, it's questionable. I really want to eat that food. So who knows better? The gourmet chef or the creator? That's what you're up against. When you're sitting in that restaurant with a questionable head chef, that's what you're up against yourself. Are you willing to say that at the end of the day, God's directive comes prime? Or frankly, my ego and my pleasure drives are more... Think about, I want to give you something here. God had to pull himself out of creation to such an extent that his will is no more important than a pork sandwich. Because otherwise, how could a pork sandwich be a choice? So there's God's will, the infinite creator, who's completely perfect and devoid of every sufficiency, saying don't eat the pork sandwich, unless it's a life-threatening condition, in which case it's a mitzvah to eat it. And there's your will saying, phew, BLT on granary. Good, good, yummy, good, like it, enjoy it. Now, God's not going to rescind on the BLT thing, unless you're in a life-threatening situation, in which case it's a mitzvah to eat it. But in a normal situation, all things being equal, it would be a sin to eat it, i.e. you'd be taking yourself away from in line with God's will. But you've got to think that this pork sandwich is as important as God's word. That's got to be an illusion. He has to create that for you. Because it really isn't an illusion. It's really not true. His will is far. He made pigs. He gave a concept of taste. He gave human being tongues. He understands salt, bitter, sweet. He designed all that. He put that in your mouth. He made your palate have thirst, desires, and things like that. And then made pigs, made slaughterhouses, made granary bread, designed wheat, genetically put together the lettuce, cut the lettuce up, the tomatoes, made the entire country where tomatoes come from, built the sun so the sun ripens the tomatoes, cuts them up and puts them all together. And Simon says, right, what do you want to do? You've got to go, it's 50-50. You've got to go, what God wants is 50%. That's 50, I'll give that 50%. And the BLT is 50%, right? So God's will is no more important than a pork sandwich. It just isn't. Unless you make it more important. Or you make it secondary to your desires. That's the test always. Adam had his test, and we now have ours. The difference between us now and Adam previously, as we'll get to, is we're loaded towards negativity now, which we'll talk about later. And why that's fair and stuff like that.
Why would
Andy, it's such a fantastic question. I'm so glad you asked that. Thank you so much. Elaine, yeah, you got a question? Oh, yeah.
Why haven't we done number five?
You're right. Why haven't we done... How could I have missed that? Let's finish on point five. Now, you'll see now, I've written on point five, a word above point five. I've said watershed. Point five is the watershed we've been waiting for. Among the things that one must realise is the fact that man has been radically altered from this prime directive that we've originally designed around the executive board table. Now, as a result of Adam's sin, a great change must have took place, I would add, to make things even. Transforming both man and his world to a large degree, entailing many things and having numerous effects. When we speak of man and his environment, we must therefore distinguish his state before the sin and his state afterwards. I've got to go back to the guy with the pushka. Guy with the pushka. Do you want to give that 50p? Do you want to give that 50p? You've never made a free will choice in your life before. Up comes the time when you've got the opportunity and you decide, I'm not going to give it. You ruin the lot, right? That person has now become uncharitable. He's now a different person. To give that person a new free will choice, you can't just give him another charity box. He's already decided he doesn't want to do that. You have to bring everything down a notch to make things even again. When Adam sinned and said, you know what? God's will is secondary to my will. Not only in his own mind, he's literally, his eyes have been opened to good and bad. A low level of perception. That means the entire world must be degraded from true and false down to a world of good and bad to make an arena of free will available for this new lower level creature. He's ruined himself. He's ruined himself. Now that he's ruined, okay, but the free will test still has to happen, right? Which means I have to have new things in the world. Lower level good, lower level bad, which for him... Look, if you'd have gone up to Adam Arishan and said, would you like a pork sandwich? He was like, unfortunately, I can't eat meat. I've only been given herbage to eat. This isn't even a question. It's not even a question. That's why she had to offer him a fruit. At least it was within the realm of possibility. A BLT is not in the realm of possibility. If I'm real. I can't do it. Meat, I can only eat herbs. What about this herb? That one's a dodgy one. Don't know about that one. That one's quite exciting, actually. I don't know. But a BLT is not on the level for him. Now that he has gone down to a lower level, loads of new opportunities must exist on the new lower level for this creature. As he has sunk to that level, then you have to bring the radar down to him so that the free will is on that level for this new kind of humanity. It's a version 2 of creation, where version 2 is more degraded than version 1. Usually when we get upgrades, they're usually better, right? But this was a downgrade. It has to be. Because if God... That's why, by the way, it banished him from the Garden of Eden. Says you can't come back. Why? You don't belong in such an environment. If you're in that environment, it doesn't work for you now. You can't live in such an environment where there's God strolling around the garden. You can't live like that and make a choice. You are a low-level being. You live in a low-level place. Go outside. Come back in 6,000 years. Which, by the way, is one divine week. 1,000 years is a divine day. We learn that out from Tehillim. You didn't work it out this week, come back for Shabbos next week. I'll see you next week. Mm-hmm. Pick up your pieces, and I'll see you next week. So the whole world has to be degraded for a week, a divine week, where we pick ourselves back to a level where we can knock on the door again and say, can we come for Shabbos this time? And we've figured it out. But for that week, you've got to be living in an environment which has a lower level, more coarse, more physical, more grob kind of choices than Adam had. Adam had all these supernal choices of ego. We have choices of bacon. Those are our choices. He didn't have the choice of flesh of swine. We do. Those are grob choices. What are we talking about? His choices were, should I do the directive thing that God actually spoke to me about, or should I not? That's point five. So we've done point five and six. We're going to stop at point seven and we'll pick up the action at point seven next time. Is everyone comfortable with that? Are there any questions about what we've done today that you need clarity on?
Is that why man doesn't live as long as cow?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question one more time.
It's why man, because of the degradation, has gone right down. We
That is a beautiful idea. You're right. God said that man was first of all created immortal. I have a genetic basis for this. You know, our cells in our body are perfect machines. Everyone should feel comfortable to leave, by the way. Our cells are perfect machines. You put energy in, they'll just chug out energy. There's nothing to stop them. Like trauma, radiation, damage will stop them. But if you just leave them on a petri dish, put energy in, it's got a mitochondria on there, churn out adenosine triphosphate, it'll just live. When it dies, do you know why it dies? There's a gene which tells it to stop and die. And scientists call this phenomenon apoptosis, pre-programmed cell death. Because unless there's a code to say stop and die, it wouldn't. It's a perfect machine. There's nothing to say. Why should it degrade? God said, the day you eat of this fruit, you shall surely die. Which means he wouldn't die had he not have eaten it. Now that he's eaten of it, why must he die? Because he's not in a state to get the perfect reward in his lower level state where bacon's an issue. He's got to be rebuilt. This is the Jewish concept of the resurrection of the dead. It is now a vital, repatriative medical procedure which we need to rebuild ourselves up to this level so that God can fulfill his original protocol. So mortality has to be the outcome of that first degradation. Because now that he's on this lower level that we talked about, he can't stay in Garden Eden anymore. He's got to come out. You can't give him the perfect reward. If you said, well done, now you can come back in. What, like this? Like this? It's not going to work. It has to be rebuilt. So God incepted a new genetic code, which we have defined on the Human Genome Project, called apoptotic codons. Pre-programmed cell death that turns around to the cell and says, right, stop and die. And it does it in perfect waves. Designed perfect waves of death that flow through cells. It's designed. No one can argue. If you could stop or block those genes, you'd find the key to immortality. It's interesting to note that the Rambam states that resurrection of the dead will be accomplished by 70 great human tzaddikim who will be scientists. And he also talks about the sterile and pure environment that will have to happen in, quoting verses from Job. Be a genetic rebuilding. Genetics is a big thing. It's an amazing concept. I hope that answers your question. People, it's been really real. We've touched upon really intense deep stuff. Thank you so much for coming.